Our text today is Psalm 110. It is the most quoted psalm in the New Testament for good reason. Also one of Martin Luther's absolute favorites for good reason. Luther said this about Psalm 110. "This beautiful psalm is the very core and quintessence of the whole scripture. No other psalm prophesies as abundantly and completely about Christ. It portrays the Lord and his entire kingdom and is full of comfort for the Christian. For he is a loving, comforting king and priest for those poor, miserable, suffering, and plagued Christians while on earth." His words are apropos and set up, I think, exactly what we need to take away from a psalm as powerful as this. Hear now the word of the Lord. "The Lord says to my Lord, 'Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool.' The Lord sends forth from Zion your mighty scepter. Rule in the midst of your enemies. Your people will offer themselves freely on the day of your power in holy garments. From the womb of the morning, the dew of your youth will be yours. The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. The Lord is at your right hand. He will shatter kings on the day of his wrath. He will execute judgment among the nations, filling them with corpses. He will shatter chiefs over the wide earth. He will drink from the brook by the way, and therefore he will lift up his head." The word of the Lord. Kids, when you like to show someone that you love them, what are some of the things that you do for them? Do you like to make stuff for them? Maybe draw a picture? Or make something that you took you a while to put together and then you get to give it to them as a present? Maybe you like to do something your parents finally told you, right? Maybe do your chores extra nice or something like that. When you all of a sudden want to do something nice for somebody, how come you want to do that? What makes you want to do something nice for somebody? I bet it's because you all of a sudden realize how much they love you, right? When you know your mom and dad love you, doesn't it make you thankful? It makes you want to do something nice for them, right? At least I hope it does. Our verses in the Bible today tell us that the way that God helps us want to serve him is by letting us know how much he loves us. And sometimes, kids, it's going to be hard to remember that God loves you. And know what? Sometimes you're going to think he doesn't. But if you're someone who trusts in Jesus, he promised he'll always love you and he'll never, ever stop. Even when you do things that are wrong, he promised he'll forgive those and keep loving you anyway. So, kids, know what I would love for you to do? I would love for you guys to ask God to help you remember how much he loves you so that you can be remembering that to love him. Okay? I want you to think about that while we go through the rest of the sermon, okay? All right, thank you for listening. One commentator I read this week in preparing for this sermon said, "To the modern scholar, Psalm 110 is full of puzzles. To the ancient church, it was full of treasure." I hope that's the way we walk out of here today. It is puzzling. It's been likened by one to just some grenades that David seems to be throwing without tying a whole lot together. It actually has a wonderful logic to it and is, I said already, the most quoted psalm in the New Testament for a reason. There is a highlight here in the unfolding story of God's redemption that is a real major turning point. Because here and only here are we told that Jesus, in addition to being the prophet we'd already heard about and the king we'd already heard about, is going to be a priest. But the question should arise to those who know their Old Testaments, how's that possible? Only the Levites can be priests. And the Lord, in giving a prophetic vision to David about what would one day be true of this king who he already knows is going to descend from his own line, God lets him know just how he's also going to be a priest, which is what we need more than any other of his offices to save us. And so there's a lot of unnecessary, in my opinion, controversy about who is doing the talking in here in verse 1. Again, we mentioned earlier in the Psalms, I wish our English translations did not do Lord in all caps when it comes to the name Yahweh, because it's just confusing. And it's not helpful. It doesn't give us the real full power of what's being said there. So if you look in verse 1, if your Bible has Lord in all caps, David is saying, Yahweh said to my Lord the following. So who is David's Lord? Sadly, many people don't want to take Christ out of the picture completely here, and there's absolutely no way you could possibly do that unless you want to completely contradict Christ himself on who is being discussed here. Christ asked the Pharisees one time when they were trying to trap him, one of those wonderfully fun moments. He says this in Matthew 22, what do you think about the Christ? Whose son is he? They said to him, the son of David. He said to them, how is it then that David in the spirit calls him Lord, saying, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I put your enemies under your feet. If then David calls him Lord, how is he his own son? The text goes on to say, and after this, they dared not ask him any more questions. So Christ himself here is saying, David said by the Spirit that the Lord, being talked about, lowercase, is the Christ and is also David's son. So there's no way around it. Yahweh is speaking to Christ, and what he's doing is commissioning him to go rule among your enemies. And David is being given a glimpse of what this descendant of his someday, this Messiah king, what he's going to be doing in ruling the way that Yahweh has commissioned him to rule. So he begins by saying, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. And the right hand, you should be used to that, but it doesn't mean like vice president, okay? For our culture, the vice president doesn't have a whole lot of power, okay? But picture more Joseph in Egypt. Joseph was ruling Egypt. It didn't mean the Pharaoh was non-existent. The Pharaoh endowed him with all of his power, so he'd go goof off and have fun while Joseph ruled Egypt. So that's the idea. The father doesn't disappear and say, I'm going to take a break. You be king for a while. The father's still reigning. He has to. Sovereignty is part of who he is. But he is conceding authority to Christ here to be ruling for him, even though his authority has gone nowhere. And so doing that, he says, here, I'm giving you my scepter, the symbol of my power. The Lord sends forth from Zion your mighty scepter. Rule in the midst of your enemies. So Christ, with the scepter and the authority of God, but again, he possesses all that authority himself. He is God as well. Remember, each member of the Trinity is equally God, but they take on these roles so that they can accomplish this plan of creation and redemption. And so he commissions Christ, sending him forth until his enemies are a footstool. We talked about this when we covered Joshua last summer, if you're with us, but often a symbol when you had conquered another nation, you would take their king or any of their leaders and you would symbolically come and put your foot on their throat to say, I got you. Okay. And from that comes this idea of the enemies being your footstool. So he is saying, I'm commissioning you to keep ruling until all your enemies are gone. And we know that Paul says the last enemy yet to be destroyed is death. He has won now, and we are waiting for his final consummation of all things so we get all the benefits of what his kingdom means. We have all the spiritual ones now, and the rest is yet to come. But in David's day, that was not yet the case. The king had not come even his first time yet. And David's wondering, what's this king, this descendant of mine, going to do someday? And he gets a glimpse now. God had already promised him his throne's going to last forever, but he's going to rule with my scepter until all his enemies are destroyed. And then he promises him he's going to have an army of willing servants that he is going to lead into battle. And there's somewhat of an obscure line there in verse 3 that translators are all over the map on. It says, from the womb of the morning, the dew of your youth will be yours. Wouldn't you love to be given that guarantee? It's like, what in the world does that mean, right? While scholars are all over the map on the specific wording of it, they're fairly on the same page with what the ultimate meaning is. The idea is this. Christ's kingdom and his rule are being described here. And there's this picture of the sun rising in the morning, and mysteriously to the ancient world, dew is everywhere. And the symbol of freshness and youth, and it's the dew that God often talks about, that he is the one who sends so that things can thrive and live. And it covers the whole world. His rule is being described as that. All the energy of youthfulness that dew represents, of new life. Your kingdom is characterized by what? Bringing new life to the world. And it will be as ubiquitous as the dew over the world. And yes, as mysterious and quote-unquote miraculous as this dew that just appears in the morning. This kingdom, this army that God is going to establish for Christ is done miraculously by his work. And they're going to come from all over the place, and they won't be from where you expect. And who in their right mind, in setting up a kingdom to basically take on all the Roman Empire is going to throw at it, would say, I know who I want, these 12 dudes over here. No one in their right mind would do that. But again, that's the kind of kingdom we're going to have here. God is going to create these ready servants to go and serve, and they're going to come, from our perspective, out of nowhere. Because they are miraculously brought from death to life by the Spirit. But all this is setting up what the crux of this passage is. So God commissions Yahweh commissions Christ. Go rule. It's going to be in the midst of your enemies. It means there's going to be a battle you are going to face until you finally make your enemies your footstool. But then all of a sudden, with no real transition, we have the crux. And God doesn't talk this way very often. Please note the adamant mood here of God. The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. Okay, that is very powerful language for God to take. And then he says, you are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Again, it's just like a shot out of left field. Like, what? What's going on, Melchizedek? We haven't heard about this guy since back in Genesis 14. How'd he come up? I remember being very, very mystified by him as a kid. Here's Abraham, back in Genesis, trying to figure out how he's going to conquer some of these Canaanite kings. And all of a sudden, seemingly out of nowhere, walks this guy, Melchizedek. And he's king of Salem, which we should read as early Jerusalem. King of Jerusalem, and his name means king of righteousness. King of Salem means king of peace, the author of Hebrews tells us. Here this guy comes out of nowhere, and he's called priest of God Most High. From where? The Bible doesn't tell us. And in very foreshadowing actions, he breaks out bread and wine to Abraham and blesses him. And Abraham realizes, this guy is so far my superior. We have all this plunder here from these Canaanite kings. I must give a tenth to him. And the author of Hebrews says, Abraham worshipped him in that, and even that Levi, still generations away, still in the body of Abraham, he says, acknowledged that he was the greater priest. That can only mean one thing, that Melchizedek was called a Christophany. As Christ appeared before he took flesh in the womb of Mary, he appeared as the battle of the army of the Lord to Joshua. And he appears here as this priest. So he has established that there is this priesthood to initially just bless Abraham and move on. But we find out why this priesthood was early established. Because God is going to say later on, there's going to be another priesthood based on this very being. It's actually going to be him. But now, finally, fully, not as an appearance, but in our flesh. And the reason this is so important is because nowhere else in the Bible have we heard that the Messiah is going to be a priest. We've already heard of you ever heard of Christ's threefold office? He's prophet, priest, and king. We've already heard he's going to be a prophet. In Deuteronomy 18, God said this to Moses, I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brothers, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. That's why in the Gospels, you'll notice many people are asking Jesus, are you the prophet? And yes, he was, but he's more than that. He's also king. We've already heard numerous times. David himself had already heard that his descendant would one day be king, and that would last forever. God told him in 2 Samuel 7, I will establish his kingdom. I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. So we already knew he's going to be a prophet and a king. But those two offices alone, one who rules and one who teaches, are not enough to save sinners like us. Often the gospel has been truncated in recent years by people saying, here's the gospel message, Jesus is king. Why is that good news for sinners? Guess what? He executes those who are against him. Oh, good, that's me, thanks. Great news! No, the good news is that this man is more than a king. It is good news that he's a king if and only if you are acceptable to him. But if you're not acceptable to the king, hearing that this king is also all-powerful is purely bad news for sinners, because he is just and must punish them, therefore. So we hear now, for the first time, though the priesthood has been foreshadowing things that Christ will do, we've not heard that he was going to be one. And so Calvin was adamant when he was commenting on this passage that this was the most important of these offices for our salvation. He says this, in fact, it is the very turning point upon which our salvation depends. Because except for our reliance on Christ, our mediator, mediator meaning priest, we would all be debarred from entering into God's presence. In prayer too, nothing is more needful for us than sure confidence in God. And therefore, he not only invites us to come to him, but also by an oath hath appointed an advocate for the purpose of obtaining acceptance for us in his sight. Very grateful for Calvin's words there, because that's exactly how we need to view this. A huge moment in the unfolding story of God's plan of redemption. The Christ, who is God himself, is going to actually be our priest. Be the one through whom we can have access to God. It's because of this one verse, the author of Hebrews spends the majority of his entire epistle unpacking what this means. That's how significant of a verse this is. So I'm going to hop around a little bit in the book of Hebrews. If you're one who likes to read along, go ahead and turn there. If not, just follow my lead. We're going to start at the end of chapter 2, the very beginning of the epistle in chapter 2. The author starts planting seeds of what it means that Christ is a priest, and he is making his point better than any of the priests that came through the Old Covenant. And so he says this in Hebrews 2:17, therefore he, meaning Christ, had to be made like his brothers in every respect so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For because he himself has suffered when tempted, he's able to help those who are being tempted. And that's a sermon itself, that those two verses right there. Huge amount of stuff going on in that. But what he's saying is, for us to have a priest, what does a priest do? A priest represents typically the people to God, but also God to the people. But if he needs to represent us to God, he needs to be one of us. And those are God's rules, not ours. That's how God established it. A representative who is one of you. Let me back up. He can only represent you if he is one of you. And so we hear that Christ didn't just come to make known, hey, by the way, new laws are coming. New advice is coming. A message of a better ways to live is coming. He's not just coming bringing information. He's preaching good news, but he also is the good news. And the good news is that after all of our efforts, and Israel was the picture of this, all these efforts to try to attain God's favor by living in the land, by their obedience, it all fails. And even though he had beat out idolatry and stuff like that by sending them into captivity, and they never followed after the pagan religions again after that. Sure, there was flourishes of a little idolatry here or there, but never the wholesale running back to all these horrible things they were doing in the Old Testament. They learned their lesson. We must follow Yahweh. but they replaced those things with a far more insidious idol. And by the time Christ was here, they were worshiping their own performance so much, that Christ said, you guys who aren't practicing all this pagan stuff are worse than they were. And that is hard for me to reckon with. Because if you ask me what's worse, all this pagan stuff they were doing, or struggling with self-righteousness, pagan stuff, it's got to be worse, right? That just means I don't think the way God does enough in that category. The good news, beginning in chapter 2, we're going to have a representative who was made just like us in every way, just as human as you. Nothing about him was less human than you. But he jumps ahead in chapter 4, in verse 14, and says this, since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. It is very difficult for me, and I imagine for you, to think that Christ was at all able to be tempted in every way just as we are. And there is one difference that does not contradict what the author says here. Christ did not have a sinful nature. Okay, so there was no natural draw towards sin the way you and I have it. However, he had the entire salvation of humanity resting on him. And should he mess up one time, it's over. Additionally, he had the devil focusing primarily on him. I know sometimes you think that's happening. No offense, but none of you are important enough for the devil's time. He's not omnipresent like God. Yes, he works in other ways we don't understand, but if you're a ruler of some country, maybe you might have the devil's private attention. Congratulations. But he has all these things aimed at him, okay? So please don't write off what he went through because he doesn't have a sinful nature. On top of that, please don't let his divine nature in your mind bleed into his human nature and by default wipe it out. I know we've gone over this before, but the correct answer to the question, why did Jesus remain sinless? The correct answer is not because he was God. That's the wrong answer. Kids, I'm not saying Jesus isn't God. He is God. But that's not why he remained sinless. Yes, his divine nature cannot sin. His human nature could. It was the same nature Adam had. So how do we reckon with that? Orthodoxy says we're not quite sure. Okay, we don't understand how this can all be in one person and not be two people. That's beyond our understanding. But we do know this. The Bible flat out says he was tempted just the same way that you and I are. And the answer to why he never succumbed to all those temptations is this. He tried really hard. Please reckon with that. Isaiah prophesied what his life would be like, and he said, I have set my face like flint, and I will not be moved. That's why he never sinned. This has huge implications for how you perceive the Father's perception of you. So the example I love to always go to, when Christ is in the desert for 40 days, how hungry would you be after 40 days with no food? Calculate whatever that is in your mind and give Christ the same level of hunger. He doesn't have divine power filling his stomach. He's as hungry as you would be, as weak and feeble as you would be. And when the Spirit was ministering to him, that's what kept him alive, okay? Kept his spirits up. But when the devil came to him and tempted him with food, and Christ knew succumbing to that way would be putting God to the test, so he couldn't do it, in his heart, he chose to love God more than doing that. So how easy would it be for you to turn down that option of food after 40 days? I got an example for how we handled that. In paradise, we couldn't stay away from one fruit. Okay? and in a desert with no food for 40 days, Christ does not give in. Why is that so significant? If he's your representative, then that's how God looks at you. Not as just some guy who phoned it in because he was God and it wasn't hard. You are credited with trying so hard your whole life never to sin that you passed the test, you made it. That's the kind of pride God therefore has in you. So we've got to own what it means to really have a priest. Whatever happened to him is credited with happening to you. That's what it means that he's your representative. So we move on to chapter 5 in the book of Hebrews. And in verse 7 he says, in the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverence. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered. And being made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him. He was designated by God a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. Here's what he's unpacking there. And this is hard for us to reckon with because we have often, as Western Christians, a dehumanized Jesus. Why did God listen to Christ? Because he was reverent. Christ was earning a spot to be heard. Verse 8, did that raise your eyebrows? He learned obedience by what he was suffered, and then he was made perfect as a result? Any alarms going off? We know that Christ, in his divine nature, of course, knows all things. In his human, those similar things are set aside. So he could honestly say, I don't know the day or the time or of the Lord's return. He's not lying there. He learned things. And as he obeyed the Father, he learned more and more of what even his mission was. But as he is growing, not in changing errors growing, but gaining a fuller understanding of what the Father has sent him to do, which is prophesied here in Psalm 110. Go, rule, defeat my enemies. He passed the test. He never once gave in. And that we often just say, well, he had to be perfect so he wouldn't need his own punishment. True, but that is cutting out half of the gospel. If he also doesn't give you his perfect record, you're not getting into heaven. And God is looking at you with, at best, annoyance, at worst, anger. Because we sin too much for him to look upon us with joy and delight. And so Christ, passing the test, was made perfect, meaning he never once sinned. He handed to God perfected humanity. I did it, God. You wanted someone to finally love you with their heart, soul, mind, and strength all the time? I did it. Because it was a joy to do it. Here, I'm giving it to you now. Give it to all of them because they'll never do it. And give me their sinful record and I'll be punished for it so they don't have to undergo that. That's what he does. And by being perfected, now he's sealed again. His human nature was started off like Adam, but now it's perfected. It cannot fall. And that's what we're all destined for when he finally brings us home. Finally, natures that will never, ever be able to fall again. We often talk about going back to Eden, but it's better than that. Eden fell. Where we're going in the future, when God brings heaven and earth together, we will never fall. Because Christ was made perfect through suffering in our place and handed to God perfected humanity once and for all. So it's in doing that priestly work. That's how he's going to defeat his enemies, because the ultimate enemies are not the people who annoy us or even who persecute us. The ultimate enemy are the powers of darkness. And as Paul says, the final enemy of death. And as Christ handed God perfected humanity and died in our place and then rose again also in our place, finally, death started to work backwards for the first time since the fall and has been working backwards ever since. And finally, when he returns, death will be swallowed up in victory. And so far more than just a king to beat up the guys we don't like, far more than needing just a prophet to tell us information, we need a priest. And I would suggest, imagine that all of us here probably don't value Christ's priesthood for us enough. I think very often we could probably, if our thoughts were broadcast and honestly interpreted, I would imagine that many of us spend more time griping about needing a better king than we have. We would like God to do things differently than he's done in his ruling of all things. We would never go there if we had a proper understanding of how precious it is that he's our priest, of what it cost him to die the death that we deserve, and what it means that someone who sins as much as I do gets to walk into the throne room of God whenever I want, not worrying he might cast me out, but actually to expect his face to light up with as much delight as it does when he faces Jesus. If I own that, and if I cherish that the way that I should, you think I'm going to gripe at how God, the hand God's dealt me? Not a chance. Because it's all going to seem so much more precious because it's going to be seen in its proper light. So as a result of defeating the powers of darkness and sin and death, verses 5 through 7 talk about what the progress of this kingdom is going to look like. And so in verse 5, David now begins doing the talking. And he talks to Yahweh and he says, "The Lord," meaning Christ, "is at your side." So Yahweh gave David this glimpse of what this Lord, Christ, is going to be someday. And David responds, saying, "The Lord is at your right hand. And he will shatter kings on the day of his wrath. He will execute judgment among the nations, filling them with corpses. He will shatter chiefs over the wide earth." Again, this is put in terms of the old covenant. We must remember that. In the old covenant, the enemies of Israel, enemies of God's people, were physical. They were actual nations and physical people. So yes, the way you won victories for God's kingdom in the old covenant was you slaughtered the bad guys and you heaped up the corpses and you took the land that was not rightfully theirs. But for us, we know this is talking about something far bigger. Ultimately, this is referring to two things. Christ will finally, when he deems it fit to return, have destroyed all his enemies, ultimately the powers of darkness, Satan, and death. But also, we know that this includes those who will reject Christ, those who think they can stand against his kingdom, those who think they don't need what he offers, think they can either reject God completely or hedge their bets that they can stand up to what God needs and they don't need Christ. Whoever has rejected Christ for whatever reason, they should hear these words and tremble and repent and turn. Not simply continue on what they're doing. They should hear these words and realize, no, he will have ultimate victory. For us, it's a great comfort. If God is not for you, if God is against you, these words ought to absolutely produce mortal terror. Then in verse 7, we get a very different depiction than what we've been expecting. We have all this smashing of everything that stands against him, heaped up corpses. And then he says, by the way, he's going to stop by a brook and get a drink and lift his head up. What? Okay. Whatever that means. Again, scholars are all over the map on some of these things too. But I said there's a good consensus that what it means is that Christ is not the kind of king while his reign is progressing this side of heaven, okay? He's not the kind of king who sits back in the luxurious tents and expects his subjects to go out while he's just waiting for a report. Christ's zeal for the commission that Yahweh gave him at the very beginning to go rule in the midst of your enemies, pursue them to the end, that Christ is leading the charge. And his zeal for what his Father has called him to do is of his utmost. And so he's out there in front of the troops. And the kind of pursuit he is leading against his enemies is the kind where he's not stopping for refreshment every few moments, but if he's thirsty, he's going to stoop down, get a drink out of the stream, and keep moving. That's the kind of relentless pursuit for the justice and kingdom of the Father that Christ has. So it's a way to describe the kind of pursuit that God's enemies should expect. He just said they're going to get smashed. By the way, if you think you can run, this kind of king doesn't stop. He will do everything the Father called him to do. And because of that, he can lift up his head, it says. When you first read that passage, it might sound like he's so tired. Finally, maybe this brook will show up and he'll get a sip. Maybe he can like, oh, lift his head up. That's the exact opposite picture of what the psalm's describing. The lifting up of his head is a head held high in victory. A common ancient Near Eastern phrase you're going to see for a picture of absolute victory. Because he is going to do what the Father told him to do, even though it meant what? Coming down to earth, taking on our flesh, being born from the womb of one of his own creatures, being cared for, fed, being hungry, tired, and then finally killed by his own people that he came to save. Because he's willing to do all that and then continue to be a priest and intercede for his people and then rule over them to ultimately destroy his enemies. Because of all that, that he was willing to leave the Father's throne to do, he's going to go back and be at the Father's right hand and hold his head high as he should, because his name is going to be above every name and exalted. So the psalm is, with very terse kind of bullet points, describing, as Martin Luther said in the beginning, all that Christ is going to accomplish for us. But there's one point I want us to turn back to that is so important, because we need to make sure we are looking at, okay, what does this mean? Not what does this mean to me? But the idea of what implications does this psalm have for me? If he's going to do all this, how do I respond? Back in verse 3, the Father promised that Christ would have an army. Verse 3, your people will offer themselves freely on the day of your power. The day of his power means when he begins his kingdom until the end. His kingdom came when he came to earth the first time. It's been growing ever since and will continue to grow and thrive until he returns. And it says God's people in that kingdom will offer themselves freely. The Hebrew more literally reads, they will be free will offerings. That's what characterizes a Christian. And not what you have to go do to be one. You trust in Christ to be one. But what characterizes a Christian, what would describe us, it sounds very much like Paul in Romans 12, doesn't it? Therefore, brothers, in view of God's mercy, again, remember this followed 11 chapters of explaining what Christ has done for us. Because of all that, Paul says, in view of God's mercy, offer yourselves as sacrifices that are living, holy and pleasing to God. And this is your reasonable worship. And how in the world do we get to the point where we find ourselves, yes, I want to be willing. I want to be a free will offering to give myself to what your kingdom promotes and not just what I want all the time. Well, I think it starts by realizing how else he describes us in verse 3. What does he say is true of us? They will offer themselves freely on the day of your power in holy garments. Please don't skip over that. If we don't have that, which is a symbol for everything he accomplishes for us as a priest, then we are not acceptable. And the image of being clothed with Christ and clothed purely and cleanly over filthy clothes is one the Bible uses a lot to describe what happens from going from death to life, being clothed in your own filth to then being saved, now clothed perfectly. But it's holy garments. It's not just clean. It's those devoted to him. In many ways, someone would suggest this is almost the idea of the priesthood of believers. But the idea is this. Because as priest, he came and said, clothe them with what I've earned. Now they don't have to worry about self-preservation. They don't have to worry about doing enough good to get God on my side. If I know he's done this for me once and for all, I don't have to worry about myself. I can truly say, I want to serve my neighbor and not, do you see me doing this, God? Am I getting credit for this? Because if no one sees it, I guess it's not worth it. God has said, I'll love you like Christ forever. I don't have to worry about his love for me ever again. I can just actually truly serve my neighbor and not have it actually being self-service, trying to get points for it. I can freely offer myself to God no matter what my earthly circumstances are when I am moved by the eternal perspective that his priesthood has earned for me. We could be like Daniel saying, they might kill me for this. But I'm looking towards Jerusalem out my window every day, no matter what they say. Because that's where my hope is. God's going to take us home. Babylon might kill us here, but I know we're going home. So remembering your eternal perspective does not make you of no earthly good. Look what it did for Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. It said, live forever. I'm sorry. You have to kill us, though, if we're going to bow to this command that would violate what God's called us to. And how did their careers go? Very well. But did they trust in what they accomplished in Babylon? No. They looked toward Jerusalem for hope. Remembering that Christ is your priest is the only place that hope can come from. Because this world does hurt. It's full of the sin we've caused and the sin that's been done to us. And all the implications of that. And though we have perpetrated so much and contributed so much to this mess, Christ said, you guys, the ones doing all that, yeah, you're the ones I came to represent. You're the ones I came to die for. You, filthy, miserable, former enemies of mine are now my adopted brothers and sisters. And everything I want on earth, I'm giving to you like you did it. So you can have hope and not rely on self. So I hope you see why Martin Luther extolled this psalm the way he did. So much is wrapped up in little short terse statements about what Christ will do for us, but don't let the format of those statements, please don't let those undermine the power behind them. Because while they may be simple, simply stated truths, they're truths we must hear again and again and again. Just like Israel thought they didn't need manna in the desert and longed for something more exciting, it was their only hope. And God faithfully sustained them with it day and day and day again.